Okay, so this lecture is going to be based upon Capital in the 21st Century, which came out in France in September, and is about to come out next March or even February at Harvard University Press. So, and it will come out in German a bit later, I guess, early the following year. So this is a book about the global dynamics of income and wealth distribution since the 19th century, and it uses, so in the book, I should say right away, the book is completely non-technical, and I'm putting together a lot of historical data, but most of all, I'm trying to tell a story based on this data. I'm trying to give a general interpretation of what I have in this data. But basically, it uses historical data that has been collected over a long period of time, over the past 15 years, together with many people. So I first wrote back in 2001, I wrote a book called Les hauts revenus en France au XXe siècle, which was using the income tax data for France, starting in 1914, which is when the income tax was created in France, until the present day. And since then, I was very fortunate to find many other people who have been working with me. Atkinson worked in the UK and in many other countries. Saez worked with me in the US and Canada, Japan. Alvaredo worked in Spain, Argentina. Fabien Dell did some work in Germany and Switzerland. Many people joined their forces to collect all this data together. So the first part of the data of the book is really this world top income database, which you can find easily online, where we have constructed this top income shares series for over 20 countries, including a number of emerging countries, because there are a number of emerging countries where the colonial power established an income tax pretty early. So typically India, the British set up an income tax in 1922. It is the same in Indochina, it is the same in Indonesia, the Dutch set up an income tax in the early 20s. So we also have a number of emerging countries in the database, and we're trying to extend it. Okay, so this is the first set of data that is in this book that comes from the income tax returns, basically. Now, I'm not going to talk too much about this part and about top income shares, and I'm going to talk mostly today about the second part of the data that is in the book, which is more about wealth and capital per se. Okay? So, of course, wealth and income are related because wealth is partly the accumulation of saving from income. But wealth is also about inheritance, of course. Wealth is also about natural resources, so it's not all out of saving. And also, the nice thing with wealth is that you can have a longer run perspective because wealth has been registered for a much longer time than income. So with income, the problem is that you start, in most countries, you start around World War I. Well, in Germany, or at least in some parts of Germany, you can go to the 1880s or sometimes 1870s, but you don't go much further in time. Whereas when you study wealth, for instance, in France, we have pretty good data on inheritance starting around the time of the French Revolution. And in Sweden, in the UK, we can go back to the early 19th century. So it's quite important to put the 20th century into this longer run perspective because, as you will see and as you already know, the two world wars during the 20th century had a major impact on the distribution of income and wealth, and basically a major equalizing impact on the distribution of income and wealth. But if you start with income, if the data starts in 1914 or 1913 in the United States, 1909 in the UK, you don't have sufficient long-run perspective to really understand what was going on in the decades before World War I. So it's very important to have a broader, longer historical perspective. And this is what also the study of wealth and capital gives you. So in this book, I am using data based on inheritance tax starting around the time of the French Revolution. And I am also using national balance sheets, which are national estimates of national wealth in relation to income, that actually exist in particular in Britain and France starting in the early 18th century. And there was this long tradition of national wealth estimates in particular in France and Britain, and also in Germany in the late 19th century and early 20th century, in the US starting in the early 19th century, which allows you to tell the story of wealth in relation to income over this very long run perspective. So the book is really trying to give justice to each national history and national identity around wealth and income, if you wish. Now, today's presentation, I'm not going to be able to do that as much as I would like to, because you know the book is pretty long, and there's no way I can summarize everything in 40 minutes. So maybe today's presentation will be a bit more technical, and I will focus on more purely economic aspects than you would find in the book. And you know, I apologize for this. Okay, so there are four parts in the book, and I will mostly present you know some results from part two and three. You can get all the graphs online for free. I was not able to put the PDF for free online so far, but I will, you know, I will do it at some point in the future. But when my publishing company stops looking at me, but so far I cannot. Okay, so I'm going to try to make three points in the next 40 minutes or so. One is going to be about the return of capital in the old world, by which I mean Europe and Japan. And we will see that wealth income ratio, so the total value of wealth in a country divided by 1 year of income or 1 year of output, these ratios are returning to very high levels, which basically were observed prior to World War I, but it took a long time to recover from these huge shocks. And the simple, so I will show you that there's a very simple formula, beta equal s divided by g, that allows you to understand what's going on. And you know, usually complicated maths are useless, but simple maths sometimes can be useful. And this is a formula which is simply telling you that you accumulate a larger ratio of wealth to income, beta, when you save more. So S is the saving rate, so it's not too surprising that if you save more, you have more wealth in the long run. The other important factor at the denominator is G, which is the growth rate. So you accumulate more wealth in relation to income when you save more and when you grow less fast. So population growth in particular is included in G. So in a country where that is stagnant, so to put it in a much more intuitive way, a stagnant country is a country where wealth coming from the past can become very important, okay, because you add new wealth every period. So wealth coming from the past can get very, very large indeed, as we will see. Now, this per se is not necessarily bad. You know, after all, it's better to have more wealth than more debt. And in Europe these days, we tend to be obsessed with debt, but in fact, we are more wealthy than we've ever been. Well, our governments tend to be poor, but collectively, rich countries are rich, and rich European countries are richer than ever in terms of total wealth that we own collectively. So per se, this is good news. You know, the return of capital is something good, except that it raises the issue of inequality and concentration. And so the second point of the talk will be about the future of wealth concentration. And maybe one of the key lessons from the historical evolution I look at in the book is that when you have a higher R minus G, where R is the net of tax rate of return and G is the growth rate, then inequality can get very high, because basically wealth coming from the past gets capitalized faster than the growth of the economy. And this can lead to very high wealth concentration level in the future. And the third point I will try to make, if I have time, but it is possible that I don't spend too much time on the third point, but maybe we can talk more about it in questions, will be about inequality in America. So in the US, inequality of wealth and inherited wealth has been historically less important in the overall structure of inequality than in Europe, for one simple reason, which is that when you have much bigger demographic and population growth, wealth coming from the past is less important. You know, you have 300 million Americans today. You had 3 million at the time of independence. So, of course, the past does not exist. In France, we were already 30 million at the time of the revolution, and we are today 60 million. So, you know, it's almost the same families, or you know, not quite, but, you know, the country has increased in population, but to a very, very slow pace. So, of course, wealth coming from the past is more important in the country where the population has just doubled in two centuries and in a than in a country where it has been multiplied by 100. But so on the other hand, the US inequality model, if you want, is based on much more extreme inequality of labor income. So it has really a different structure than the of old world model. And of course, you can combine both aspects in the future. And this could be, you know, the worst of all world or the best of all world. Well, you know, I guess the new world has always some combination of the two. And we try to address this a little bit in this last part. Okay, so let me start about the first part. And you know, sorry if this sounds a bit technical to you. You know, the book is much less technical than this presentation, but you know, I thought it's important in this sort of more academic presentation to try to show you that sort of very simple economic reasoning can is useful to understand important historical evolution. Okay, so according to economics textbook, you know, wealth income ratio or capital output ratio are supposed to be constant. But you know, we should always be very careful with textbook. And very often in economics textbook, you know, when we don't know much about something, we assume it's a constant, and you know, which makes it easier. In fact, you know, when these so-called Kaldor facts were proposed in the 1950s, there was almost you know, very little historical evidence, so they were based on very little historical evidence. And what we observe in Europe and Japan in the recent decade is a very large increase of the ratio of the capital stock to income, going from about 2-3 years of income in the 1950s, 1960s, which means that on average people will own 2-3 years of annual income in wealth at the level of a country, going to 5-6 years of income in the early 21st century. And as we will see, it's as if we were heading back to the very large ratio of national wealth to national income that we had in the 18th, 19th century, which in fact, you know, some you know, economists are surprised by this finding, but in fact, it's not really surprising in the sense that when you have, you know, in the modern theory of economic growth, we are supposed to produce output using capital and labor with what economists call a production function. And the basic belief of economists is that you know, we have a flexible production function, you know, meaning that there are different ways to produce output. You know, you can have different quantities of capital. And you know, there's no reason why this should be a constant historically. And it could very well be that in the future we have you know, even more capital than in the past. You know, I don't know if you read the news about Amazon a few days ago, but their plan is to use drones in order to distribute books. So this is an example of huge capital intensity, you know, where you have drones just to distribute the books. So this would be an example of a huge beta, okay, where you have a huge stock of capital relative to annual income. So there are many things, you know, in an extreme robot economy, you know, beta could be very large. And this is not just theory, this is also about history. So this is the evolution of the value of capital stock in, so Britain is the country where we have the largest number of estimates of the capital stock starting in the early 18th century. Okay, so what do you have on this graph? You have a huge U-shaped curve, you know, in the sense that you have the shocks of the 20th century that are very visible in the decline in the total value of wealth in Britain. And then you have a recovery at the end of the period. And in the end, you know, around 2010, so this is the value of everything people own in Britain. So you can see that today, half of the wealth is going to be housing, so residential housing, and half of the wealth is going to be other domestic capital, which is basically the value of firms located in the UK. So this is the equipment, the machinery, the offices, the factories. This also includes immaterial capital. You know, this includes the value of the patents and the research and development that's embodied in companies. You know, this value that market prices, you know, this is whatever goes into the stock market capitalization of companies. It also includes what the government wealth, but these days governments are pretty poor, so it's mostly private wealth. Okay, the government part, you know, the public debt these days is as big as the public assets, so the net public wealth is close to zero, and 98% or 97% of national wealth in the UK belongs to private hands these days. But this has not always been the case, so it's important to take the sum of the two and to look at the national wealth defined as the sum of private and public wealth. Now, what do you see when you go back over through time? Well, you can see, of course, in the 18th century, agriculture was important. So agriculture was, you know, 2/3 of output, and it's not surprising to see that agricultural land was also about 2/3 of the capital stock. Okay, so agricultural land has disappeared over time. Well, it is still there in Britain, but its value is very small. So now, you know, these days, if you want to be rich, you know, agricultural land is not going to be enough. And you can also see that already in 1910, agricultural land was almost negligible. So in France, you have the same evolution, except that it takes more time for agricultural land to disappear. So typically in 1910, you still have over 1 year of national income for the total value of agricultural land, so you can still be somewhat rich with land. But this is, you know, in the end, in the long run, this is disappearing. And you can see in France that you also have, in fact, even more than half for the housing stock right now. You know, it could be that the price of housing in France is a bit too high right now, and you know, maybe it will go down a little bit. But you know, the general long run evolution is not a bubble. You know, it's a real evolution that goes with the fact that, you know, first the nature of wealth has changed enormously in the long run. You know, from agricultural land that's been replaced by housing, has been replaced by financial and business capital. But it's quite interesting that in spite of this huge change in the nature of wealth, the total value of wealth in the end is quite close to that in the 18th and 19th century. So it's quite interesting because sometimes we have the view that the modern economic development has to do with the rise of human capital and that human capital should replace, you know, non-human capital. Now it doesn't seem what's happening. You know, of course human capital has increased a lot, but non-human capital has also increased a lot. You know, we have a lot more housing today. You know, we are even going to have drones to distribute books, so you can see that capital is everywhere. You know, we have much more computers, equipment. You know, the buildings that we have are much more sophisticated today. You know, we can plug a computer in the wall and it works. You know, so this has nothing to do with the kind of capital that we have a century ago. So in the end, in the long run, everything is going up. And the overall balance between human and non-human capital doesn't seem to change that much in the very long run. And it's already quite an important finding, I think, as compared to some views of what the modernization and development process is all about. That there's nothing in technological change per se that necessarily makes human capital more and more important over time relatively to non-human capital. So we don't know where this is going to stop, but you know, in any case, right now we seem to be sort of heading or almost back to the kind of total value that we had in the past. Another interesting thing to notice on this graph is the complete destruction of net foreign capital following world wars. So in the UK it was even bigger. So in the UK. So net foreign capital is how much you own in the rest of the world as compared to what foreigners own in your country. Okay, so you can see that the UK had huge foreign investment, huge foreign reserve on the eve of World War I. So almost 2 years of national income. In France, it was about 1 year of national income, which was a lot. So Germany at the same time was less than 50% of national income. So of course, the colonial empire of Germany was much less, and then this created a lot of tension, as you all remember. So, you know, owning other countries was really a part of the reality at that time. And this huge stock of foreign assets basically disappeared during the World War. Including, you know, in the UK, there was very little physical destruction of capital, of course, on UK soil during the World Wars. But in the end, the stock of national capital declined as much as in France or in Germany, where you had a lot more physical destruction, because the cost of financing the war in the UK was enormous. And typically what happened is that the rich British sold progressively some of their foreign assets in order to lend money to their government to finance the war. And then at the end of the war, this was all washed out by inflation. Well, it took time in Britain, because in Britain it always takes time to accept inflation. But in the end, it was this is the only way to get rid of huge public debt, or at least historically this has been the major way. And so that this is the way the foreign assets disappear. It's also partly expropriation. You know, Russian bonds are part of what the French lost in net foreign assets. You know, when the Suez Canal was nationalized, this is also a form of expropriation of British and French shareholders. But you know, at that time, in the 1950s, there was no net foreign wealth, almost no net foreign wealth anymore. So this was really not the most important issue. Okay, so if we want to think, you know, the simplest economic notion, I don't want to spend too much time in this, but a simple way to think about this very long-run evolution is this very simple formula, beta equal S divided by G. So beta is this ratio of how much you own as compared to 1 year of income. And you know, there's a very simple formula that tells you that in the long run, this should be equal to the ratio of the saving rate, S, to the economy's growth rate. So typically, if you save, you know, capital accumulation takes time. You know, if you save 10% per year, in order to build capital equal to 5 years of income, it takes 50 years, basically. So you should not be surprised that it took so long to recover from the war. You know, it takes time. Capital accumulation is a long-run process. If you just look at the past 20 years, you cannot possibly understand anything. You know, you need to take a longer-run perspective. And the other thing also to have in mind is that for a given saving rate S, you know, depending on how fast you grow, you have a very you accumulate different quantities of capital. You know, the basic intuition is that if population growth goes to zero, which is typically the difference between you know, Europe growing at 1.5% and the US growing at 2.5 or 2-3%, is that in the US you have a 1% population growth rate, whereas in many European countries now it's zero or almost negative. Then, for a given saving rate, you will accumulate a lot more wealth in Europe. You know, take the extreme case of a country that doesn't grow at all. Then, as long as you keep saving every year, you know, you keep increasing your pile of wealth. So, you know, this has to stop somewhere, and the growth rate is sort of the force that equilibrates the process. So, in the, you know, one way to interpret the Marxist model was a model where you have no long-run productivity growth, so G is equal to zero, all the growth comes from capital accumulation, and therefore, if G equals zero, then you accumulate infinite quantities of capital. At least in the Marxist model, there was a solution in the end, which is that the rate of return was going to go to zero, you know, the falling rate of profit. Now, here, what we have is less apocalyptic in the sense that as long as the growth rate is positive, you stop somewhere, but this somewhere can be pretty big. You know, this somewhere can involve a lot of capital. And again, this per se is not necessarily bad, but it can create problems in terms of distribution. So I have shown you France and the UK in the very long run. This is the picture for the recent period, in 1970-2010. So these are the top eight developed economies in the world. So you can see that it's a pretty general phenomenon. So Germany has the same general increase as other countries, but starting with lower levels and still at lower levels of... So the market valuation of both the real estate stock and the company sector are less in Germany, and we can talk more in the discussion about this interesting issue about Germany if you want. But at this stage, I want to say that the general evolution is pretty much the same across the board in Europe and in Japan. So in the short run, bubbles can be important. So this is the Japanese bubble of 1990, very large price for real estate and the stock market. But in the long run, you know, it's more than bubble. You know, you can see that in every country, the wealth income ratio used to be between 2 and 3.5 years of income in wealth in 1970. Now every country is between 4 and 7. So this is clearly not a constant ratio. You know, this is going up. And the simple way to understand it is this formula. You know, you have growth slowdown, particularly in Europe and Japan in terms of population growth. Therefore, you tend to accumulate more wealth. Now, this seems to go together with a general increase in the capital share. So, you know, there are two different concepts here. So, the capital share is what is the share of national income going to profits, interest, dividend, rent, etc. So, you can see that in most countries, this has gone up over the past 30 years from about you know, 15 to 25% in the back in the 1970s to 25-30% today. I actually think that capital shares are less well measured than the capital income ratio, but the fact that both move together is consistent. So technically, this is consistent with a model where the what economists call the elasticity of substitution between capital and labor is bigger than one, which in a non-technical way simply means that there are many different things you can do with capital. Okay, so when capital can be used for very different purposes, and you can, you know, basically, so typically in a complete robot economy where you could replace everyone by capital, this would be an infinite elasticity of substitution sigma. You know, you can replace the Amazon workers or the mail workers by drones. So, I mean, we don't have to be so extreme. I'm just saying it looks as if sigma is bigger than one, so it doesn't have to be infinity. But for some reason, economists used to believe that it had to be exactly equal to one, in which case the capital share is constant, because when sigma is exactly equal to one, when you increase more capital, the return to capital is going to fall exactly in the same proportion as the increase in the volume of capital, so that the product of the two, the share of national income going to capital, is going to remain the same as before. Now, that doesn't seem to be the real world. It's not as harmonious as according to this assumption. You know, and in fact, even in the standard, you know, this is the most standard model you can think of. This is a minimal departure from the assumption of so-called Cobb-Douglas assumption, where sigma is exactly equal to one. And this is the only way to explain what we have, which is a long-run tendency in the increase of the extent of capital. Now, this is not necessarily, again, having more capital is not necessarily bad. You know, it's better to have more capital than more debt. And you know, the fact that Europe has a lot of capital net of debt today, and more than ever, is in the end, is good news. You know, it means that actually we are about to leave to the next generation more capital in proportion to GDP and national income than ever, including after taking away all the debt, all the public-private debt. So, you know, this is a good thing. Except that the distribution of capital and wealth tends to be a lot more concentrated than the distribution of labor income. So this creates a new forms of sort of extreme inequality, which maybe in the post-war period we thought that we had managed somehow to make it disappear in history. And you know, maybe in the post-war period we thought that inequality of labor income, inequality of wages was the only remaining form of inequality. So this sort of comeback of very extreme inequality of wealth, you know, creates a major tension in the way we perceive inequality. And so, you know, what you need to have in mind is that the situation has been improving over the 20th century, but probably less than what some would have expected. But still, you know, the concentration, you know, in all European countries, the concentration of wealth was really extremely high until World War I. You know, typically, almost 90% of the wealth for the top 10, so nothing left below the top 10. Whereas today, you know, it's only, if you wish, 60% for the top 10, or 70% in the UK or in the US, and 60% in most European, continental European countries. So the difference is that now, you know, the bottom 50% of the distribution still has next to nothing, but the difference is that the middle 40%, which is, you know, which I define as the people who are not in the top 10 and people who are not in the bottom 50, and which we can think of a sort of patrimonial middle class or wealth middle class, they used to be as poor as the poor, as poor as the bottom 50%, and now, you know, they own 20-30% of aggregate wealth. So typically, these are people who own, you know, the orders of magnitude. If average income is 30,000 euros per capita, and if you have 6 years of income in wealth, it makes average wealth around 200,000 euros per capita. So these are typically people who own 100,000 euros, 200,000 euros, up to maybe 300,000 euros. So with that kind of wealth, you are not very rich, but you are not completely poor. And you know, you don't like to be treated as poor politically. You know, it's a big change in the political landscape. The fact that now almost a third of national wealth belongs to this group. You know, we should not underestimate the change. I think this is a major change. The key question is, how did it happen? Will it last? So will the middle class expand in the future, or will it shrink? You know, that's So why is it that there was this decline in wealth concentration? So, you know, what's interesting is that with France, you can, you know, we can construct a wealth inequality series starting around the time of the French Revolution. And what you can see is that until World War I, there was no decline at all in wealth concentration. You know, if anything, wealth concentration was increasing until World War I. It's even more, if you look at Paris, so here I focus on the top 1% wealth shares. You can see that in Paris, you know, this is going up to 70% for the top 1%, which is really an incredible level of wealth concentration. And as you can see, you know, it's, I don't know what would have happened without World War I. You know, nobody knows. We are not in the field of controlled experiment, and we are not going to redo the history again without the war. But at least there was no obvious tendency for decline or even stabilization. Okay, so I think that's quite interesting because, you know, especially at that time in France, you know, people like to describe France, or at least some of the economic and political elite like to describe France as a country of small property owners with very moderate inequality due to the French Revolution. Well, as we have seen, you know, agricultural land did not matter anymore at that time. So, you know, the French Revolution, which in any case did not redistribute much of the land, but that was a way. And, you know, there was no reason why you know, a republic should accumulate less concentration of wealth than a monarchy in Britain. But still, you know, at that time, the big story in France was, you know, we don't need progressive taxation as much as Britain, because Britain is aristocratic and they need wealth redistribution much more than we do. Well, in fact, the wealth inequality in France at that time was just as extreme as in Britain. And, you know, it's quite striking and in a way depressing to see that there was no, you know, it was something like a parliamentary democracy, but there was no political reaction to this. And, you know, this was just going up and up and up. And this is a bit frightening. So we see, I'm not going to show you for each country, but this is, even though the data is less good for the 19th century in the UK or Sweden than in France, we see the same general pattern everywhere, which is that until World War I, there's no tendency to a natural decline in wealth concentration, and wealth is really very, very much concentrated. So key finding is that there was no decline in wealth concentration prior to World War shocks. So was it just due to the shocks? You know, this seems like a natural interpretation. Now, the next question, which in a way is more interesting than the, you know, discovering that wars were important in the 20th century, is not a major discovery. So I guess what's more interesting is, apart from these huge shocks, what forces determine the long run level of wealth concentration in a country? And my main argument in the end in the book, if I want to summarize in a very quick way the conclusion, is that in any dynamic theory of wealth accumulation, where you have random shocks to either individual tastes or living bequests, or this can be demographic shocks, you know, sometimes people die very late, sometimes they die very early, sometimes they have many children, sometimes they have very few. So this creates, you know, always some mobility in the distribution, either upward or downward. Sometimes people go bankrupt with their wealth, sometimes they get huge capital gains. So you have all these kind of shocks, but whatever the structure of these shocks, the steady state level of wealth concentration will be an increasing function of R minus G, which, where R is the net of tax rate of return to wealth, so how much on average you earn from your wealth, and G is the growth rate of the economy. And with growth slowdown, which we already talked about before, and rising tax competition to attract capital, it might well be the case that R minus G is going to keep rising in the 21st century, in which case, you know, wealth concentration might under plausible assumption, might reach, possibly be above 19th century record levels. You know, in particular, if G, you know, I want to emphasize again the role of not only productivity growth in G, but also population growth. You know, in population growth is important. You know, if you want to reduce inequality, in particular inequality of wealth in inheritance, please have a lot of children. You know, because in a In a country where everybody has 10 children, you know, of course, inheritance does not matter too much because you have to divide everything by 10 every generation. So basically, you have to save a lot, and new wealth matter. Now, on the opposite, when you have a population decline, which can be relevant for Germany and a number of other countries, you know, in the extreme case of a country that is about to disappear, you know, where the population goes to zero, you know, the last generation is going to inherit everything that was accumulated for the several thousand years. So, I mean, this is a very extreme case, of course. This is just to make you understand that the reverse effect of the story where everybody has 10 children is the story where people, say, have only one children per couple, where you inherit from both sides, or from zero side if both parents are poor, of course. And so what I mean by this is that the demographic regression per se creates a world where inheritance can matter even more than in the 19th century. You know, there is some sort of pure demographic effect to the dynamics of inheritance, which is quite frightening in some ways, and which also has impact for the overall inequality of wealth in the very long run. Maybe one point that I should emphasize is, you know, sometimes people are surprised that the rate of return to wealth can be bigger than the growth rate forever. You know, you should not be surprised because this is really what happened during most of world history. You know, during most of world history, the growth rates were very small. So, you know, of course, we don't know very much about whether this was exactly 0.1 or 0.2%, but we know for sure that this was very small simply because you know, if we have a growth rate of just 0.5%, this will mean that, you know, world population was zero at the time of Christ, and you know, we have evidence that there was population at the time of Christ, and we have evidence also that the level of income, although it was pretty small, was above starvation levels because people did not all starve. So just by, you know, simple reasoning can make you sure, you know, these are the Madison GDP historical estimates, which are the best estimates we have, but even without any estimate, you can be sure that the growth rate during most of human history were extremely small, you know, much less than 1% per year, and in fact, probably much less than 0.1, 0.2% per year. You know, the society would just reproduce itself in an almost identical way from one generation to the other, whereas the rate of return to wealth was typically 4-5% per year. So typically the rate of return to land was 4-5% per year. You know, if you open any novel of Jane Austen or Balzac or in any other country, you will see that the price of agricultural land is typically between 20 and 25 years of 1 year of annual rent going to the landowner, so which corresponds typically to 4-5% return. So in any case, it was much bigger than the growth rate, which was 0.1, 0.2%. So the rate of return to capital was, of course, much bigger than the growth rate for centuries and centuries. And this creates absolutely no problem at all from purely economic viewpoint. It is just that it leads to very extreme concentration of wealth, which was exactly what we observed. And so we sort of forget about this during the 20th century, because during the 20th century, first, the growth rate were extremely large. About half of this was due to population. So half of this very large growth rate is due to population, and the per capita growth rate were about half of this. And we are just coming out of this period. You know, if we take, so here I'm just using the UN projections for world population, according to which world population will stabilize in the second half of the 20th century. So this is just the per capita growth component, which, you know, 1.5% in the long run is relatively optimistic. You know, some people, Roger Gordon or other economists, believe it will be less than 1%. You know, I think nobody knows, but in any case, we can be sure that the population growth of the 20th century is over. You know, the demographic transition is already behind us in most countries, and therefore the total growth rate has to decline. So the gap between the rate of return and the growth rate is quite likely to increase. What also happened in the 20th century is that, okay, this is a pre-tax rate of return, is that you had huge tax and also destruction and marginal capital shocks. So if you compute the same graph but looking in after tax and after shock terms for the rate of return, this is what you get. So, you know, again, you know, the exact numbers, the exact estimates are approximate, although, you know, I tried to do the best I could. but the orders of magnitude are clear, which is that during the 20th century, the rate of return to capital after tax, after capital loss, was exceptionally low. And so, you know, if we, I think this is the main explanation in the end for the fact that the steady state level of wealth concentration came to lower levels than in the past. Now, according to this, you know, there are reasons to believe that the concentration of wealth will rise in the future. This is what we seem to get according to the so this is the Forbes billionaire ranking. So as you know these days people have to buy magazine in order to know what happens to the wealth distribution, and so usually scholars have a lot of contempt for what's in this wealth ranking of magazine. And you know, I certainly agree that how they get their number is not clear at all, and their sources and data sources and methodologies are not well specified at all. But you know, at least they are trying to fill some social demands that you know, official national statistical institutes are not really filling properly. So in particular, household survey on wealth are not able to monitor trends in top wealth holdings and cross-country wealth and foreign wealth in a way that is satisfactory. And so, you know, at least, so here the data exists. So what do we get from this data? You know, I think we should be extremely, you know, careful about this data from wealth rankings in magazines. You know, to me, the main reason for having automatic exchange of information and some form of progressive capital tax at the world or European level is to be able to produce more democratic transparency on wealth. And you know, I would prefer that people get their data from Eurostat or the IMF than Forbes. But you know, at this stage, Eurostat and the IMF don't really know what's going on in terms of distribution of wealth. You know, in Cyprus earlier this year, you know, the IMF was telling everybody that the Cyprus banks were owned by Russian oligarchs, and that the European taxpayer should not transfer money to the Russian oligarchs. And that was probably partly true, except that when you ask to the IMF people, do you have any statistic about the number of Russian oligarchs, and are these oligarchs with 1 million euro, 10 million, 100 million, well, you discover that they have no statistic of any kind about this, which is a problem, you know, because it's not easy to monitor a world financial crisis with no data. And so, it's a real problem. So anyway, this is what we have. This is Forbes magazine. This is not great, but what we have is at the top of the distribution. So this is a fixed fraction of the world population, and we can see that this is going up. You know, the average wealth level for this top fractile of the world distribution is going up at a rate between 6 and 7% per year after deduction of inflation, so in real terms, which is, you know, 3 to 4 times bigger than the average growth rate. Okay, so let me remember you that the world GDP over this period. So I look at this period just because Forbes starting publishing their world ranking of billionaires in 1987. The world GDP has been growing at 3.3% per year. But again, you can see that population growth is important. You know, more than half of this growth is just the growth of world adult population, which has been growing at 1.9% per year. So the per capita growth is just 1.4%. Okay, so the world economy is growing, but a big part of the growth is population. You know, so 1.4% per capita term, the average wealth is going up a bit more than income. This is because the beta is rising. The ratio between wealth and income is going up. So average wealth, so this is true in rich countries, but this is also true at the world level. Average wealth is going up quite a bit faster, you know, 50% faster than average income. But the top of the distribution is going up at 6-7% per year. So this means that the distribution is getting more concentrated. Well, if this data is true, you know, in other countries like France, Germany, where magazines are trying to compile these rankings, they get similar findings. But you know, I don't want to make too much out of it. I'm just saying that, you know, this is consistent with the general reasoning I've just shown you about R versus G. and that, you know, potentially this can go, you know, this can go very, very, you know, very quickly. You know, if you have a growth rate that is three times bigger than the middle of the distribution, you know, this is a bit, this is a bit frightening. Okay, so as I was saying, you know, inequality in America has always had a different structure in Europe, you know, more egalitarian in some ways, more inegalitarian in some other dimension. So in particular, you know, if you look at the structure of wealth historically, it's very interesting to see that at the same time, the America is the place where the total value of capital is less than in Europe. Let me just show you this graph. So here I compare the total value of wealth. So this is United Kingdom, France. Now you can see that America is at the same time a land of equality in the sense that the value of wealth is less than in Europe. So in particular, you can see that the value of agricultural land is much less than in Europe. So you have more land in volume, of course, but you have so much more land in volume that the relative price of land is very small. Okay, land, that's already what Tocqueville was observing when he traveled in America. You know, the land is cheap. So anybody can be owner of land. You just come, you have a piece of land for you. So by just owning land, you cannot be very rich. But now, if you have the great idea of owning the labor that's on the land, then you can be as rich as in Europe. Okay, so America is really a place of contrast, which is that, you know, in the northern part, it's more egalitarian than in Europe. But in the southern part, you know, of course, it's a very extreme form of inequality where part of the population owns the other part of the population. And I think the relation of America with wealth and inequality has always had this sort of very ambiguous dimension. You know, in one way, you know, much more egalitarian than the old world, and in some other ways, you know, some forms of inequality related to slavery, which are more extreme. Now, if we look at the situation today, what's quite striking is that the US distribution of income has become more unequal than Europe over the course of the 20th century, and it is now almost as unequal as pre-World War I Europe, but the structure of inequality of income is very different, which is that now in the US there is actually less wealth inequality than Europe in 1913, but much more inequality of labor income. So in the US, this is sometimes described as more merit-based, you know, in the sense that at least, you know, when the rise of top labor incomes makes it possible to become rich with no inheritance, which was also the justification that Napoleon and various people in the history of France in the 19th century had about the very high wages for their préfet, or more generally for their high civil servants. You know, the view of Napoleon, and you find this also in the later period in the 19th century, is that the higher civil servants should be able to have the same living standards as the top wealth holders in their departments, you know, so that at least in terms of dignity and in terms of you know, what how they can have nice receptions and everything, you know, they look as well as the top wealth holders. Now the problem, of course, of this kind of logic is that you know, this is nice for those who have the top labor income, but this can really be the worst of all worlds for those who are neither top income earners nor top successors, you know, because, you know, they are poor, and in addition, they are depicted as basically undeserving, which at least, you know, the sort of ancien regime, or to a large extent 19th century European wealth inequality model, was not trying to depict them as particularly undeserving, you know, in novels of Balzac or Jane Austen, nobody's trying to pretend that the servants are less deserving than the owners. You know, they just happen to be the servants, and some others happen to be the owners. And, you know, maybe it's a condition for civilization. You know, that's the only way to have some people who deal with something else than their old survival and can spend time for the arts, the science, etc. So, but there's nothing that is viewed as you know, it's not based on merit. Whereas, you know, the today's modern inequality model in the US, which sort of pushes the Napoleonic prefet's logic even further, is that we try to present this inequality as based on merit or productivity, you know, in spite of the fact that it's really unclear in practice whether the rise of US top incomes has a lot to do with this. And I think it has a lot more to do with the a change in social norms in the US and also a change in the bargaining power of top corporate executive and following also the sharp decline in top tax rate. So let me conclude. I guess probably the most important lesson of the book is the first, probably that's more important than this, the history of income and wealth inequality that I'm trying to tell in this book is always very much a political history. It is chaotic, unpredictable, it involves different national identities, each country. I told you about France in the Belle Époque, the US, Germany, each country has its own national history with inequality, with income and wealth. There's no way I can, predict the reversal of the future. My conclusions are less apocalyptic than Marx, which, is not the setting the standards very high, of course, but at least, with positive growth, you have the accumulation of wealth stops somewhere. So we have a steady state in the quantity of wealth you accumulate relative to income for the society as a whole. But this steady state, with a small growth, can be rather gloomy in the sense that it can involve a very large capital income ratio, a large capital share, as well as extreme wealth concentration due to high R minus G. Let me stress that this has nothing to do with the market imperfection. It's important to realize that, in fact, the whole purpose of a perfect capital market, in the sense of economists, is that anybody, any dull successor in particular, can get the highest return to capital on earth. That's the whole point of a very efficient capital market, is that this is disconnected from your labor. So there's, in the logic of the market and of market competition, there's nothing that prevents R from being bigger than G, and it's actually the opposite. The more perfect the capital market, the bigger the gap between R and G. Okay. It's very important to have in mind because sometimes, even the language has changed, over time. Now the word rent in the common language is very much associated to the concept of a monopoly rent. But whereas historically, in 19th century novels, the rent has nothing to do with monopoly power. It's just the rent from capital. It's just the income from capital. And whenever capital is useful, if drones are useful to transport books, well, drones will earn an income. It has nothing to do with monopoly power. And I think it's important to realize that high R minus G has nothing to do with monopoly power. So you can have more perfect competition, and it's always nice to have more perfect competition, of course, but you're not going to solve this. And it's important because, these days, particularly in Europe, we tend to believe that, if we eliminate every monopoly rent, everything will be solved in the world, and, I think it's a bit more complicated. The ideal solution would be a progressive wealth tax. There are many other solutions, in China, you can get very rich, but if you try to take your wealth away from China and go to Switzerland, you lose it immediately. That's called capital control. In Russia, you can take it away, but if you try to do politics, you end up in jail, which is another way to regulate capital. Perpetual population growth, like in the US, is also a way to make inequality sort of viable, because you have such a renewal in the population, that the bottom 50% to a large extent comes from the rest of the world, and this makes inequality much more acceptable. The only problem is that this cannot be transposed at the world level, because if we all move to America, then we have to find another solution for inequality. So we have to find something, and I think progressive wealth tax is more suitable to the particular genius of Europe, but this will probably take some time before we get there, and this will probably be a lot more chaotic than this. Sorry for being so long.